He's a writer for Athlon. He will fill you up with a ton of great information online at athlon.com. On Twitter, use at Luke Easterling. Luke, great having you. How's life treating you these days in the 813?
Hey, doing great down here. It's getting back into the mid to high 80s. So I miss the cool weather already, but yeah, we're doing great down here.
Well, hop a plane out here. We got plenty of cool weather to go around. I'm buying.
Hey, don't tempt me. Don't tempt me.
You know, I mentioned USF, and when they played Oregon, first of all, wow, that it's 17 years ago. They were actually...
Oh, don't say that. Don't say that.
Yeah, I have this awful tendency of bringing things up, and people are like, you're making me feel old. Stop. but
hey, I'm dealing with a draft class in which we have Marvin Harrison Jr. and Jeremiah Trotter Jr. and God knows who else, so I already feel that way.
Yeah, well, I've got a 10-year-old grandson, so I'm going to up the ante here.
There we go.
When that game happened, it's crazy to think that was kind of a new program under Jim Levitt. I'm always curious, just as a student, what do you remember about that time? You know, that team had a nice little run back in the old Big East. You know, so your thoughts as a student, your view of that team at that time.
Yeah, I mean, those were glory days for that program. I mean, they started in 97, went from literally like three tiny little rundown trailers, like back behind the baseball field on USF's campus. And if you drive over to Fowler and 50th right now, you'll see a much different experience of USF football. But yeah, back then it was wild because it just kind of, you know, it came out of nowhere, and they went from, I mean, their first game ever, they played it at the old Tampa Stadium, the old Sombrero, right? They played Kentucky Wesleyan University, and they beat them 80-3 in their first ever football game. I don't know how many people know that, but that should have told everybody from then on this wasn't going to be a normal program because, I mean, within a decade, I think there was a year where they went, you know, the year that they went from 1AA to 1A, they went 9-2, and the only teams they lost to were Oklahoma, who went to the national title game that year, and Arkansas, who I think won the SEC that year. And so you fast forward a couple years later, that Sun Bowl game was like right in that time frame where, I mean, I remember being at Raymond James Stadium when number 9 Louisville came to town, and USF just beat the brakes off of them. Urban Meyer brought his Bowling Green team, number 24 overall, down to Tampa, and that was the first ever ranked win that USF ever had. We stormed the field that night after we beat Bowling Green.
Nice.
And then you go back and look at, you know, USF beating number 5 West Virginia. They beat number 2 Kansas. They went on the road and beat Auburn in overtime. I mean, there were so many iconic wins for that program. They had a little bit of a downturn. I spent a lot of time with Alex Golish, who's the head coach there now, and watching what they did last year, going from winning 4 games in 3 years to going to being bowl eligible and beating Syracuse, I think 45-0 in their bowl game last year. So glad to see them back on the upturn under Alex Golish.
Yeah, I remember talking to USF people right before the bowl game, and the common theme was trailers, legal pads, and phones, and they built a program.
They did.
You know, I know you do mock drafts, and I always have this vision that you kind of get in a zone like those guys who walk on the hot coals and they put you in like an isolation chamber. So I'm always curious your process when you're dealing with 32 teams, 1,000 prospects, you know, how do you put it all together to come up with a mock?
You know, my process kind of evolves throughout the season. You know, that my process changes with the actual draft process. So I do mock drafts really all year because I think it's a fun way to track, you know, who the names are to look out for. I think it gets fans encouraged and excited about the upcoming college football season when you kind of match them to, you know, these are the players you should watch if you need this kind of position. So I think it bridges the gap for the NFL fans and the college football fans. That's kind of why I fell in love with the draft as a kid in the first place. And so my process starts at the very beginning throughout the summer and going into the season, you know, saying, hey, these are the players that I think should be in the first round. These are what they think the teams should do. And it kind of stays that way up until, you know, the combine time of the year. You know, once the season's over and we get through the Senior Bowl week and the All-Star games and the combine and start to get into pro days, my mock drafts kind of switch gears from this is what I think they should do or this is what I would do for each team to more, you know, this is kind of what I'm hearing. This is what I expect the league to do. This is what I think teams will do. And obviously when free agency happens, that impacts that as well. So this time of year, my mock drafts are much more about what I think will actually happen and not necessarily who I would pick. And then that's kind of how it is up until the draft itself.
Talking with Luke Easterling, Athlon Sports, NFL Draft. So when Bo Nix arrived here before 2022, I could tell you nobody was doing back handsprings. His time at Auburn, more of a mixed bag. Then he had two great seasons. I know fans tend to overvalue their guy. I think he's got a good chance at playing in the league. So what's your evaluation and maybe a possible landing spot for him next week?
Yeah, I think the best things that Bo Nix brings to the table are really important for playing the quarterback position particularly. It's a guy who, you know, he's had to overcome adversity. You know he's had to overcome some things and bounce back, like you said, that experience at Auburn where there were some really high highs early, really low lows, you know, towards the end there. He ends up at Oregon. So he knows how to bounce back. He knows how to overcome those things. Obviously, the mental toughness it takes to go through those things, to even just to make the decision to leave Auburn, to be kind of a legacy, you know, quarterback there after having his dad play there, and not just to deal with all of that pressure, but then to make the decision for yourself to say, hey, I'm actually going to go create a different legacy, a new path for myself somewhere else, and then to actually deliver and do that. I think that will appeal to a lot of NFL teams. I think he's a very accurate passer, again, very efficient, knows how to distribute the football. And honestly, I think the fit that I get really excited with Bo Nix is in Denver. I think the things that make him the best version of what he is, I think would mesh really, really well with the way Sean Payton likes to run his offense. And obviously, that's a team that desperately needs a quarterback. So I don't know if it happens at 12. I don't know if maybe they look to move back a little bit. Maybe they trade back into the late first round. I don't know if Bo goes that high, but I really, really like the fit there with the way Sean Payton, again, wants to run his offense, and I like the scheme fit there. I think he would do as well as he could anywhere in Denver.
I saw you had a tweet about Troy Franklin, and the bottom line is Oregon has not been an NFL pipeline for receivers. I mean, they've only had three drafted over 15 years, just one as high as the second round during the Super Bowl era. I've been here 34 years. He's the best I've seen for this program. How does he translate to Sundays? Last week, you put the spotlight on him. What's your read on him as a pro prospect?
You know, my read on him is people are going to point to the fact that he's kind of thin, right? He's got a lean frame. He's tall and explosive, but can he hold up at the next level? And I just say go watch modern NFL football. You know, go see what the game looks like on Sundays nowadays. You know, not everybody, not all the wide receivers are Julio Jones and Calvin Johnson anymore, where you expect your number one receiver to be 6'3", 6'4", you know, 230 pounds. Not everybody can have a Mike Evans. You know, that doesn't work that way. But go look at how many receivers in the league who are smaller than we've, you know, historically said you have to be a number one wide receiver. Justin Jefferson is probably the best wide receiver in the entire game, and he's really, like, he's pretty lean.
Yep.
So I think when you look at the way Troy Franklin wins, he wins with explosiveness down the field. He wins with really sharp routes, knows how to create separation, short, intermediate, deep, whatever you want him to do. And he is a smart player. He knows how to get out of bounds. He knows how to, you know, get as many yards as possible and try to eliminate those hits. And there will be, you know, the old school folks that are like, nah, don't run out of bounds. And then there will be the new school folks that are kind of like, nah, I'd rather extend my career and be able to play longer because I'm only 187 pounds or whatever it is. So, you know, I think his skill set meshes really well with the way the game is going, the way offense is played. I think he's going to be a quarterback's best friend. He can, again, take the top off the defense explosively. He can create yards after the catch. And, again, a great route runner that is going to get open consistently. And I think that's one of the most important, most translatable traits to the next level is, can you create space for yourself, not just for your quarterback to have an open target, but to be able to create yards after the catch with the space you created before you got the ball. I think he does those things really well.
Well, I'll tell you, as somebody who tops out at 140, I'm all about living to play another down. I'm talking with Athlon's Luke Easterling. So much good info, by the way. Check out his work. I want to get to the Remington Award winner, Oregon's Jackson Powers Johnson. First of all, just for the personality and sound bites, he's awesome. He's a center. He finishes blocks with what I consider, you know, a little bit of anger. What's the book on JPJ and a possible destination?
I mean, I'm down here in the Tampa area. I'm a big Bucks guy, always have been, and I would love to see him in a red and pewter jersey next year. we just coming off a run where we had Ryan Jensen down here in Tampa Bay, and you want to talk about a nasty dude with a great personality who sets the tone for his offense. That was Ryan Jensen all over. And I think, losing him to that knee injury was a devastating blow to the Bucks offense. That's the kind of impact. I know everybody will say, oh, first-round pick for a center? Are you kidding me? It's not. Again, the way the league is going, the modern NFL, they have found the value in that position, because not only do you have to be physical, you have to have that physical mentality, set the tone in the trenches. You have to be athletic. You have to get out on the move. You've got to be able to get those reach blocks. You've got to be able to get to the second level and neutralize those linebackers. You got to pull. You got to do everything at such a high level and do it so fast. And you've got to have it between the ears. You've got to be able to get your team in the right protections. You've got to be able to communicate with your quarterback. Understand that he's seeing things the way you are, get your guys in the right spots, and again, all that before the ball is even snapped. And I just think that Jackson Powers Johnson passes all those tests with flying colors. Like you said, I love the personality off the field. He seems like such a fun guy. I think he'll be great in the locker room as a leader. But on the field, man, I a center who is absolutely worthy of your first-round consideration, and if the Bucks end up with him, I'd be thrilled.
45 miles to north of where I'm sitting, maybe the most valued offensive lineman this side of South Bend. Another guy who's not only talented, kind of nasty about putting guys in the dirt, Talese Fuaga, all Pac-12 as a junior, second team All-American this year. He's a right tackle. Where do you see him, and what seems like a logical or a possible landing spot?
Again, another tone setter type of guy. That's one of my favorite terms to use when I talk about offensive linemen. He caught my eye about halfway through last season, and the whole rest of the year, I just couldn't find another offensive lineman in the whole country who was as consistently dominant as Fuaga was all year long. And again, I do think he stays at right tackle. I think depending on the team, they might even move him into guard. If they already have a right tackle, they would want him. Just he's the type of guy, he's so talented, and again, he's so nasty. You just want him on your team. You want him in the trenches somewhere, and I think if you moved him to guard, he could probably play there as well. But I think this draft is going to be so interesting because there's so many tackles. There's so many good ones. I mean, we could see six or seven go in the first round, and it wouldn't surprise me whatsoever. But there's kind of a flavor for everybody, right? You've got Joe Alt, you mentioned, kind of you alluded to him coming out of Notre Dame. He's kind of the prototypical left tackle. He's big. He's kind of more finesse than power, and I think I'd put Olu Fashanu from Penn State in that same breath as a pure left tackle, more athletic than power. And then you got this group of right tackles. You got, again, Fuaga, but you've got J.C. Latham from Alabama. You got Amarius Mims from Georgia. Troy Faltanu from Washington, another Pac-12 guy, not a Pac-12 anymore, RIP, but a guy, again, who could play left tackle. He could slide inside the guard. He's going to be interesting as well. But I think Fuaga, again, I think he's going to come off the board pretty early because he is such a clearly defined player. You know, there's really not a lot of deficiencies in his game. You know you can plug him in at right tackle, and he's going to upgrade that spot immediately. And, again, sets that physical tone for the whole team. I've had him in the top 15 for weeks now, and I just don't see him getting out of that range. Depending on who trades back and who moves around, I just see too many teams. Vegas at 13, I think, would be a fantastic fit. If he goes to the Raiders, that's exactly what they need at right tackle. I think New Orleans at 14, I really don't see him getting out of the top 20. Again, if you got down to 18, I think Cincinnati would take him off the board because they need that as well. But again, yeah, top 15, top 20, could be top 12 maybe, you know, depending on who ends up in those top 10 or 12 picks. But he's a nasty dude, man. He's going to go early.
Couple final thoughts, Luke Easterling, Athlon Sports. I want to get back to something we kind of glossed over. I thought it was interesting. When you look at a draft, there's kind of two schools of thought, who you think will go 1 through 10 and maybe who you think should go in this spot. But the consensus seems to be Caleb Williams 1 to the Bears. I love his game. I love his skill set. Obviously got to see him in Pac-12 country. You think he's going 1? And if you're Bears GM Ryan Poles, would you be the one to take him 1?
Yeah, I think this is kind of one of the rare things where it's what I would do and what I think will happen. I think the more interesting conversation is with a guy like J.J. McCarthy. You know, I have a second round grade on J.J. McCarthy. I think he would be a day two guy on my board. Do I think he's going top 5 or 6? Absolutely. That's the difference. You know, in reality, I know he's not going to go where I would expect him to go, where I would necessarily take him. I have Michael Penix Jr. ahead of him in my quarterback rankings, and he's pretty close to Bo Nix in that kind of second tier there. But I know better. You know, I understand the league kind of views him more highly than I do, and that happens all the time with a lot of guys. So I think Caleb Williams, I'm on the same page with the Bears. I think that's the pick to make there. I would take Jaden Daniels ahead of Drake May, but not by much if I'm Washington. But the real conversation starts after those top three guys, putting Drake May from North Carolina in there. It would be interesting to see where that next quarterback goes and how McCarthy, Nix, and Penix come off the board after that.
And lastly, being greedy, and I dated myself earlier, being from North Jersey, I date back to the Giants playing at Yankee Stadium with Fran Tarkenton as quarterback. I know the Giants pick high. I look at their offense, and I'm like, they really don't have any dangerous weapons. I know they also need help up front. What do you think happens with the G-men at six?
Yeah, they're in a weird spot, right, where if they love J.J. McCarthy and he's at six, do they want to give up on Daniel Jones and cut their losses and figure that out later and get a new quarterback, or do they help out the guy they just paid a ton of money and give him what it takes to be successful? And I think, again, the conversation for them would be, do we take the top tackle off the board if Joe Alt's not gone, which, again, he could easily go five. We know Jim Harbaugh values offense there with the Chargers now in terms of the offensive line. He could go Joe Alt there. But I just think it's such a rare opportunity for the Giants to finally get the number one receiver they desperately need, right? They've got a lot of guys that can do one thing or two things and has speed but not something else, or he's big and he can't do something else. Malik Nabers from LSU, Roma Dunze from Washington. Either of those two guys at six, I feel like, is a no-brainer for them, because in any other draft class that didn't have a guy named Marvin Harrison Jr. in it, either of those two guys would be the easy number one receiver, top five pick. And so to get either of those guys at six, I think would be exactly what that offense needs, regardless of who's a quarterback.
Well, 2 years ago, as a Duck fan, I lit my candle for Thibodeau. They got him. This time, I'm on the Odunze bandwagon. But, folks, he's Luke Easterling, Athlon Sports, generous enough with his time to jump on the show, talk some NFL draft. Follow him on Twitter. Use @LukeEasterling online, athlon.com. Luke, really, really appreciate you coming on. Be well, enjoy the draft, and look forward to talking again down the road.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, take it easy.